Yes. Nou zeg, dat is geweldig. Anyway. I'll behave. I don't know anything else but boring. You are outnumbered today, Tony. You are outnumbered. Is it live? Okay. We probably we would. Anyway. So good afternoon, everyone. As you know, this session supposedly was going to be given by Jaap, but Jaap unfortunately is sick today, so he asked if I could do that. So just for references, this is Jaap, and I'm just a much better looking version of him. Truth be told, I really try to morph Jaap into me, but making pictures morph is really difficult, but you know. Not yet, no. But this is live! So, I'll allow someone to take a quick picture. So, we are going to talk about migrations and identity options. I did not prepare this session, obviously. Forgive me any freewheeling throughout the session. But I think we'll manage to get where we need to land. I am notoriously bad on time, which means that I always run over. But the good thing is, the next session is mine as well, so I can just continue for 2 hours, right? And I'll just segue into whatever I was going to talk about in an hour from now. Anyway, first of all, really important, I really want to shout out to our sponsors of today. They made this possible here. So I know you've heard it a few times over and over today, but I want to reiterate that. Make sure to check them out and thank them in our name as well. But this being said, in the next 55 minutes or so, we're going to talk a little bit about identities and how they relate to migrations to Office 365. Now, there are many, many, many ways that you can handle identities in Office 365, and there are equally a lot of ways on how you can do migrations. Some of them fit together, others don't. So before diving into what you can and cannot do, let's do a little primer, a slide that you've probably seen many, many times before, is that when you take a look at migrating from an on-premises Exchange environment, and this is the Exchange track, so yes, we're going to cover a lot of Exchange, but it does also apply to a lot of the other workloads. There are many things that come into play. Of course, you have to take a look at where you're coming from, what size of the environment you're dealing with, how you're going to deal with coexistence, which can be very challenging because sometimes you're very limited. Just to give you an example, a customer I'm working with today, they're in a hosted Exchange environment. And let's just say that it is a little bit hostile because they're moving away from a hosted environment. So that hoster has no incentive to be very cooperative. I'm not saying they're not, but to them, they're losing business to Office 365 in a way. So that can be really challenging to work with. As such, in those situations, you might find yourself that you can't do certain things. Doing hybrid in a hosted scenario to Office 365 usually is a non-option, unless you're fortunate enough to have a hoster which has a dedicated environment just for that one customer, then you might be able to do hybrid. But reality is that that just isn't the case, right? So just keep that in mind. There is the provisioning. How are you going to deal with new mailboxes, retiring mailboxes, compliance and all that, provisioning from a various perspective, from features, but also from a user perspective, user management groups. These objects, identity management, they need to be able to be created in a way. There is a life cycle of the object. How does that fit in with whatever you have today, right? So those are all elements that come into play. And then we're not even talking about authentication. So establishing an identity is one thing, but how are you going to authenticate? And how does that even play with how you're going to migrate and how the migration is going to roll forward? Just to give you a little example, If you're going to go into a hybrid deployment, a lot of organizations choose to do so with Active Directory Federation services. Up until the point, there is a misconception that a lot of people think if you're going to go hybrid, you need ADFS. Well, that isn't entirely true. You can perfectly live without ADFS in any scenario, and especially with the newer features that have been released, like SSO and pass-through authentication, that is more than ever the case today. However, the experience from an end user perspective, especially if you're using domain-driven workstations, typically is better using ADFS. Now, there is some debate possible there, and that's probably something that we're going to carry over into the next session, but those are all elements that really can influence how you can migrate or how you should tackle a migration from on-prem to the cloud. Now, going back level, let's take a look at cloud-only identities. And truth be told, I used to be a lot very biased towards these identities. I used to be the guy that came in and says, well, you know, there is no effort in installing Azure Active Directory synchronization, AAD Connect today. It's very simple, easy, straightforward, little wizard, you run it and it works, right? But in the end, the question is, do you really need all that overhead? A lot of organizations would argue and say, well, yeah, we need Azure AD Connect, and the majority actually deploys Azure AD Connect, rightfully so. But the question you should ask yourself, is it really what I need? Had the discussion earlier this morning, someone said, well, we're going to do Azure AD Connect for 50 users. My first response was, are you sure you want to do that? I mean, I'm not against it. There are very, very valid reasons to do so, but why? Ask yourself, what is the added benefit to your own migration? Aren't you making your life harder? Giving you an example, all of us know, well, most of us might know BitTitan MigrationWiz. The problem that you're facing, well, problem, it's not a problem that you're facing, but one of the things that you might face is if you have automatic synchronization of your identities, you've got an on-premises Exchange server, then you know there are certain things that the MigrationWiz tool cannot do, like provisioning the mailbox for you. There's a lot of things that you have to automate yourself, have to take over, because they cannot influence objects in the cloud as if those were cloud-only identities. So if you have got Active Directory synchronization in place, then it automatically rules out certain scenarios. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be a blocker for the entire project, but it can be a hurdle that that needs to be overcome. So those, again, are a lot of things that come into play. Anyway, going back to cloud identities, obviously they're only in the cloud, managed through PowerShell, through various APIs, or through the portal, which, you know, since its redesign is a much, much better way of handling large amounts of users in the cloud. Authentication is entirely performed in the cloud in Azure Active Directory, so there is no tie-in to your on-premises organization. Obviously, there is the hybrid state where you can synchronize objects but still use authentication in the cloud without, you know, password synchronization, using password synchronization, but without actually federating authentication back to on-premises. So there is, you know, a little, there is like full cloud or semi-cloud, and there is then federated authentication. But the benefit that you have here is it is a very lightweight way of starting with the cloud. If you're doing a POC, unless you really want to do a fully fledged POC, just spin up a tenant, go. All your end users need to know is they have a different set of credentials, which, you know, depending on your end users, might be a real challenge to remember more than one password. But that's an entirely different discussion. Next up, we have synchronized identities. Basically, it's a cloud identity, but it's automatically provisioned through your on-premises Active Directory, which means you create a user on-premises. Through Azure AD Connect, it syncs up to the cloud. It takes a lot of the on-premises attributes from the identity, syncs them into the cloud. Some of them are left behind. Some of them are carried forward. They still have a separate username and password in the cloud, which may or may not be the same as the one that you use on-premises. And the may or may not be is really an important part, because obviously we've been told many, many times, do not use your same password twice in different online services, or, you know, don't use the same password twice, period. Obviously, most of the users use the same password everywhere, right? So to them, if you do a synchronization and you happen to be one of the good guys that was smart enough to use a UPN, which is the same on-premises as the one in the cloud, then chances are that their username is the same, their password is the same, but they're not managed in the same way. The password in Office 365 might expire sooner or later than the one on-premises. Vice versa, you can have the same result. So the problem that I see a lot with a lot of the customers I work with that face that situation where they have Active Directory synchronization, but they haven't chosen to do password synchronization because they don't want to store their on-premises passwords in the cloud or for whatever, you know, security reason they could come up with, they start happily. They hand out passwords to users, and the first thing a user does is reset that password to whatever they use on-premises, and they're happy because they only need to remember one password. 2 weeks later, their on-premises password changes or expires. They need to change it there. There's very few users, and this is just from experience, I'm not kidding, there's very few users that then go online and change their password in the cloud. By then, they're like, okay, well, I can remember my previous password, and I can now remember my first password. And then the one in the cloud expires, and they need to change their password there. Thus, obviously, they're going to change it back to the one on-premises. And then they're going to go away for 2 weeks or 3 weeks on a holiday, and they come back. Then that's when problems start if passwords start to expire, because they're not in sync from an expiration perspective. That's a really hard thing to manage. Again, not technically. It's easy for us. We know, you know, there's a password here, password there, that's this, that's that. We're done. It's not as easy as it seems for a lot of the end users. So, you know, I might be bashing them up a little bit here, but that's the truth. That's new reality that we have to live with. It's not new. We've had the same problem on premises. Why have organizations been implementing single sign-on for applications throughout their Active Directory? Well, just to overcome the hurdle of having multiple accounts, multiple usernames and passwords to manage. This is no different. We're just adding another application. So there is a lot of merit to be found when you are synchronizing identities to include something of password synchronization. Now, a discussion that we all might have had or that you will face at some point is you have a very security conscious customer, or maybe you're working for a security conscious organization, and the security officer comes to you and says, well, you're not going to store any of the passwords in the cloud because it's insecure. Well, there's two ways to tackle that. You can spend a lot of time and effort into converting them into the right side and make them understand that it's not necessarily insecure, because the way passwords are synchronized to Office 365 is pretty secure. I mean, it's salted, it's hashed, it's twice hashed, then over a TLS channel, moved over to Office 365 and stored very securely over there. Arguably, I think the cloud or Microsoft's cloud is much more secure than whatever you build on premises, but don't tell that your security officer because he won't like that argument. They'll typically shut down. But you know, that's what it is, right? So if you can't do password synchronization, then you know, doing single sign-on is another option. But the problem that we have with single sign-on, it's actually interesting. I had the talk the other day with a customer. Microsoft has in preview today two new features. It's called pass-through authentication, which is part of Azure AD Connect, and they have SSO, which is seamless single sign-on as a feature on top of Azure Active Directory. So we've got the concept of SSO, and we've got the feature called SSO. Very confusing, but that's marketing at Microsoft. Very confusing. So the other day, a customer said, we cannot do password synchronization because we don't want passwords stored in the cloud in any way. It has to be secure. Okay. Having been through that argument many, many times before, I said, I'm not even going to start this discussion. Great, Mr. Security Officer. Good. So how about we do pass-through authentication? Pass-through authentication is where credentials are passed on to the on-premises organization, and from there, Active Directory does the authentication, gives a go-ahead to the cloud to authenticate the user, and you're in. One thing I did not foresee is I thought, well, this is, you know, from a functionality perspective, a really great way, because you don't need the complexity of ADFS. This was a fairly small customer. So they don't need ADFS, they don't need to maintain ADFS, they don't need to make that highly available, so they can save a lot of money, because they have Azure AD Connect running right there, right? But then the smart security guy says, well, you know what? They cached a password on their way to your server at some point. They accept the password, and they pass along the password at some point, which means it's stored for a very short period of time. And there I was. I was like, well, yeah, he's probably right. Even though the documentation says the password is never stored ever in the cloud at that point in time, but they do get the request and redirect the request. So at some point, they do accept the user credentials, even though they're encrypted, right? But those are, you know, the discussions you're all going to have. So make sure that you fully understand how these features like PTA, we're going to go into much more detail later, how they actually work. And I'm digressing from synchronized identities like I've never done before. But anyway, really valid points, really interesting points. The biggest part of synchronized identities, though, is that it is the cornerstone of allowing coexistence with non-premises environment. So if you're ever going to go hybrid, hybrid exchange, hybrid anything else, then having synchronized identities is, you know, really what you need to the starting point. But at the same time, I do believe that the directory synchronization as it is today might change in the future. It's the root of all evil. Any of the problems you'll run into during coexistence, during management, during, you know, how your hybrid environment behaves is because of directory synchronization. So it's a blade that cuts at two ends. If you do implement it, your life will be great. If you do implement it, you'll have a miserable life. The choice is yours. But I do believe that at some point, Microsoft will solve some of the intricacies that exist around the synchronization part. Last year at Ignite, a lot of customers gave the feedback very loud and clear that they were fed up with the fact that there was no two-way synchronization of user accounts and all that. They've made very clear that they want to be able to uninstall the Exchange server once everyone's up in the cloud and you're running directory synchronization. We're not there yet. Maybe in a few months' time. Maybe not. Who knows? We'll see. Anyway, last but not least, there's federated identities. Now, the more I talk about identities in the cloud, the less I like the name federated identity, because it does cause some confusion. A federated identity is not a different identity than a synchronized identity, because the object that is in the cloud is exactly the same object with the same attributes synchronized in the very same way. There is one difference. The authentication is federated. So I'd rather call this a synchronized identity with federated authentication than federated identity. But this being said, it sounds much nicer to call it a federated identity than a synchronized identity with federated authentication, which is a mouthful. And you can tell I've practiced this many, many times before. Works in pretty much the same way, but the second to last bullet point is what makes it really hard. You need some federation solution in place. Now, ADFS is by far the best known solution out there, and it is, once you get to know ADFS, it's fairly easy. And that's at the same time true and a lie. It is easy to implement because Microsoft have really done a terrific job creating a wizard which will create anything you want or anything you need to get ADFS up and running for Office 365. Which is good because they dumbed down the process to get it up and running. But at the same time, they've dumbed down the process. So if you're knowledgeable about ADFS and you know the underpinnings of ADFS, then it's a breeze to set it up and make it work for Office 365. But in the room here, just a quick show of hands, who knows exactly the authentication flows? Let's say a client authenticates using ADFS to Office 365 using modern authentication. Who knows? Who can honestly say they know the authentication flow, what endpoints the client connects to? Don't be shy. A little bit, okay. So I know that a lot of people here in the room are very knowledgeable people, yet only 5, 6 showed their hands and said, well, I think I know the endpoints and I think I know how it works. That's a problem with ADFS. As long as it works, it's great until it breaks. And then, well, at some point you'll have to troubleshoot that. Being Exchange people we are, over time we've had a lot of experience with Exchange server, and if mail flow halts, we jump and we know, okay, well, let's take a look at this or that, you know, the queues, one great starting point to see if things are being queued on the server. We know that by now. ADFS stops working. What's the first thing you do? Yeah, that's great. I would argue and say, well, try logging in again. But yes, exactly. Looking in the event logs, basic troubleshooting 101, but there is an error in the event log that says, well, couldn't authenticate the user. And then the problem starts because there are so many pieces. Plus, there's one other problem that you'll face using federated authentication is you only have half of the view. You know what's happening on your end. You do not necessarily know what's happening on the other hand. Now, you could say that, hey, whatever up in the cloud, I trust Microsoft to run that that service and make it available for 100% of the time. And to be honest, you know, fair to them, they do a pretty good job of keeping it up and running. It's been a very long time I've experienced a big outage on Office 365 or Azure Active Directory, but the past outages, major outages, were all because of Azure Active Directory, some sort of related to that, right? So that's the difficulty. Plus, if you're a small environment, ADFS, and I'm talking about ADFS here, we're going to talk about third-party authentication or federation solutions later. If you're only using it for Office 365, you always have a way out, a very easy way out, because ADFS is down, let's convert the users to a synchronized password user, and off we go, it just takes very little time, and they can use their same password as on-premises, provided that your security officer is okay with syncing the passwords to the cloud. If he says no, well, there goes your back out plan, right? You could easily set up a new Active Directory Federation Services farm. Takes you about roughly half an hour if you've got the virtual machines running. Maybe a little bit longer, but let's just assume that it's still doable to get out of that phase where you cannot authenticate your Office 365. But none of them are really great ideal solutions. Add in other applications that use ADFS, and to be fair, it's an industry standard. Federated authentication, SAML tokens, using that to authenticate your other solutions, we're going to do it more and more. We're going to leverage that one identity, which is either on-premises or in the cloud, more and more to be federating with other solutions, third-party solutions. And then the reliance, the fact that you need that ADFS server to be available becomes even more important. It becomes a really, 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 really critical part of your environment. So better make sure that you know exactly how all that plays together. And that all adds up to the last bullet point. You see this more than you think. I think last time Microsoft shared some numbers was about a year ago about the percentage of users that use synchronized identities, that use password synchronization, that use federation. There's only a small number of organizations that actually implement ADFS or a third-party federated solution. But that small part of customers are the biggest customers. I sincerely don't know any of my large customers that don't use ADFS. So if you're a consultant, the majority actually is facing this problem. If you're not working for that large customer, and if you don't have any of these very strict security requirements whatsoever, then I'm personally very in favor of doing password synchronization, pass-through authentication, or PTA with SSO, any of these things, because they actually take away a lot of the complexity, and at the same time obfuscate a lot of how things work, because you now start depending on other components which you have no say into. But let's keep the pass-through authentication for the surprise session for later. So far from my surprise. Anyway, this is just for viewing pleasure. If you have never seen the Office 365 portal, which I sincerely hope you have, you can look through these. Is there anyone who hasn't worked with Office 365 before in the room? Okay, just checking. Anyway, if that were the case, I would ask you to leave the room. No, actually, you're in the right place then. So one thing Yop probably wanted to show you is that this is something that you can encounter, and this is a very pesky problem once you have synchronized identities. So remember I said directory synchronization is the root of all evil? Well, my biggest pet peeve with directory synchronization is not that it doesn't work. It works beautiful. It works perfectly. But it doesn't allow me to do everything in the cloud. So I'm buying a cloud service, hoping to do everything in the cloud, yet once I synchronize identities, I need to manage them using my legacy tools on premises. That's just god-awful. And that's the truth, right? And there's good reason to do that, because they don't want to mess up the service. They don't want you to fiddle with whatever it's in the cloud so that you create inconsistencies and your experience goes to hell. So I understand the reasoning why Microsoft prevents you from making changes directly in the cloud, because they don't have those write-back capabilities today. Okay, so we're all in agreement. Doesn't mean that this isn't less annoying than it was before. So again, the choice to go with directory synchronization might lead up to limited functionality, at least limited administration functionality. To your end users, there is little to no impact. There might be some delays in provisioning and all that, but that's it. It's just for the ones who need to manage the service that you have to keep in mind. Well, there are certain things that you can and cannot do. Changing a display name, have to do it on premises. Changing a password, you can do it in the cloud, provided that you don't use Active Directory Federation services. So there is, you know, various things. Also, right, one thing I didn't mention, if you do DIRS sync, and if you do password synchronization, then please do yourself a big favor. Implement password writeback so that people can actually change their passwords in the cloud. A lot of organizations don't. So ask yourself this question. You synchronize identities, you synchronize passwords, and a password expires and the user is at home. What do they do? How? Yeah, because their on-premises password expired. And because once you set password synchronization, once you enable it, the password in the cloud never expires anymore. It just expires on-premises, forces them to change the password, which then forces to change in the password in the cloud. So they can happily log in into the cloud, but they can't log in on-premises. But if you don't give them a tool to change the password on-premises when they're not on-premises, how can they update their on-premises password? Well, when they're connected to the VPN or when they are on the internal network, which, you know, goes into or goes in against the idea that you can freely work from everywhere except in the office. So if you do that, and a lot of your users are external, there is a lot of value to be found to just implement that password writeback. But there is one little small problem. It's called licensing. Yes, because you need an additional license. Now, in the early days of Office 365, it was like, you know, go to Office 365. And then there was a strong push from Microsoft. Let's go to E3 because E3 gives you everything. Well, I foresee a very beautiful future for anyone going E5 or actually E5 and EMS. Because the truth is, anything you need from a security, compliance, advanced compliance capabilities and all that, it's all part of the additional licenses, the Secure Productive Enterprise Licensing Pack or EMS, right? All the cool features are there. So this is really something that you have to take into account. And if you have any influence, have those conversations with your customers prior to them deciding, oh, we're going to do E3. Because you're locking yourself out of a lot of capabilities there, and then you're going to try and have to find other solutions to common problems like this here. Anyway, decided to move to the cloud. What if you're in the cloud? How are you going to do identity management? Are you going to use the same tools today? Another customer, great, they had tool called Delegate 365, created by Martina Grom at work. Really great tool for managing users in the cloud, providing an additional layer of security and all that. Good. They had cloud-only identities, started using that application. They were very happy. And then at some point, they hired a new administrator and said, well, you know what? I think it's a really great idea to implement directory synchronization. So he went ahead and did that. And after he did that, he found out that the tool they purchased didn't work anymore because the tool couldn't make any edits into synchronized accounts in the cloud, and it wasn't compatible with an on-premises Active Directory. So they had to go out and buy a new tool which could manage on-premises Active Directory using the same roles and role-based access control and all that, which cost them three times as much as the original tool. So, you know, there's pulling a string here, making a change there. Be very aware that all these things come together. But so it's very important to determine that up front. And why is that? Well, the next slide will be a duh moment. It's because Azure Active Directory is the underpinning for everything in the cloud. You might have heard Microsoft talk about your identity is the key to everything. Well, it is true. The identity exists in Azure Active Directory is Office 365. Any of the services in Office 365, any of the other any of the other online services, Azure, for instance. So it's all tied in together, and that's why you really want to be very aware of what you're going to do. Now, shifting to the migrations and all the how they fit in together, there's two categories, if you will. There is the non-directory synchronized options, and there is the directory synchronized options. And then there's, you know, some middle ground in between, some gray area. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the non-dir-synced solutions to migrate from on-premises to the cloud, some of which are very realistic, others which are not, right? So first of all, the first migration option that Microsoft has ever, you know, discussed is the cutover exchange migration. And in my career, up until now, I've only used it once. Quick show of hands, who has used cutover exchange migration before? How many times? One time. Twice. Wow. One. Great. So that's the point, right? It is there. It is a migration option. Is it very flexible? No. Is it very usable? No. Does it give you a great experience? No. Well, there is a saying, it's free, right? There's a reason why tools are free, right? So if your customer is 10 users on premises, you want to get them into the cloud and it shouldn't cost you more than, you know, a few clicks, might be a good option, but I'm not a big fan because it doesn't give you a lot of flexibility. The way that it works is pretty straightforward. Creates a mailbox in the cloud, copies over content, you switch over everyone at once, and everyone's happily in the cloud. That sounds like a fairy tale, which it is, because that's not how it works in real life. There's other solutions, and I'm not advocating that you know, any specific partner, but there are solutions. QuadroTech, there is MigrationWiz, there is SkyKick, there is lots of third-party vendors out there that built a suite of migration tools around doing things like that in a more smart way. Yeah, and I'm not mentioning some of them because I've had really, really bad experiences. But I'm being recorded, so I'm going to keep it very civil today. So how does it actually work from a high-level perspective? Well, very simple. Accounts are manually or through a script or through some, you know, third-party engine synchronized from on-premises to the cloud without actually invoking the Active Directory synchronization endpoint, right? So it's not dir-sync. Dir-sync is just a little tad different, but what it does is literally export to CSV, convert, and then import into the cloud and do that automated way, which basically is what dir-sync does as well, right? But dir-sync uses the FIM engine under the hood. Once the accounts are exported, then you export mailbox data. And the way that it does is pretty smart. You know, the cutover exchange migration connects to the on-premises exchange endpoint, extracts the data, and imports them directly into Office 365. The one time I had to use the cutover exchange migration was, again, because of a very interesting guy called the security officer. And the security officer said, well, you know, we've went through a risk assessment program, and we've assessed that Microsoft is safe. So yes, the data can go to the cloud into Microsoft, but no other third-party cloud provider. Well, if you're going to use some of the third-party cloud providers, they need to be able to connect into your environment. Sometimes they stage the data temporarily before they inject it into a mailbox in Office 365. Well, if that's the case, well, then that immediately rules out these vendors. Turns out they all do that in some shape, way, or form. So it left me with one option: use a Microsoft tool because it's living in Microsoft's data centers and pulls in data from your Exchange server directly without staging it elsewhere except inside Microsoft. So these are sometimes really interesting, you know, little discussions that can influence what you can and cannot do. This being said, the process is fairly simple. Once everything's moved over, pre-staged, if you will, switch over MX records, tell your users, see your new username and new password, log into your new mailbox, and life goes on and you live happily ever after. At least that's the theory. We're forgetting about reconfiguring Outlooks, we're reconfiguring the mobile devices. There's, you know, sometimes things that just don't work, like Outlook profiles getting corrupt. Why would they, right? That's reality. Technically, it works fine. We all know that. But technically, that's not our problem these days. Our problem is the end user. I mean, many, many, many years ago, when, you know, animals could still talk, an exchange migration was all about the backend and making sure that you could actually get data to move from one end to the other one and make sure that data survived in the process and that it worked. And you didn't care as much about the clients being used because they would, you know, figure it out on their own. That was third-level support or first-level support that had to take care of that. It's true. Today, however, migrations are super easy. I mean, 2010 to 2013 to 2016, sure, there's some backend stuff that you need to do, but once the backend works, it just works. I mean, just moving a mailbox is click and it moves, and then the problems start, like Outlook doesn't reconnect. Oh, corrupted items. Oh, this, oh, that. And that's what you should care about. As a migration consultant, you know, the discussion on how you're going to do a migration typically is a non-discussion. There is one way, or there's maybe two ways to do it right. And maybe those two ways are on the table that you can discuss because one is maybe a little bit cheaper than the other one. But anyway, that's a quick discussion. How you're going to handle your end users is a bigger, more important discussion, at least. That's what I believe. Anyway, use Outlook Anywhere if you use the cutover migration. or RPC over HTTP, which is now called the legacy protocol as well. Although it's not really that legacy, is it? Anyway, less important, invoking cutover exchange migration through the migration option in the Office 365 portal, more specifically in the Exchange Admin Center. I do believe that today you can actually go into the user section of the portal and from there can invoke a migration directly even. So this screenshot might be a little outdated, but essentially it shows you the same thing, but it's just a shortcut to the migration page that you can see here. Free, as I said, free tools are great, but there is a reason why they are free. And in some cases, instead of going through the trouble of doing a cutover migration, I just tell people, you know what you're going to do? Your 12 people in your office, great. They're all in the same office, or even better, export to PST, import into Office 365, let them do it itself, give them a free mailbox or an empty mailbox in Office 365, and off you go. Your migration just cost you half a day of work. You do this, it'll probably cost you a day or maybe a little bit more, but that's, you know, that's how interesting cutover change migrations are. Anyway, third-party migrations, we briefly discussed that, so I'm gonna move over that one, and I want to go over what if I want to do a cutover migration and then move to DirSync later. Can I do that? Sure. DirSync has what they call soft matching and hard matching processes, where you can already have objects in the cloud that match an object on premises, and then you just have to make sure that certain aspects of that object match. User principal name is a great one. It's a way to make sure that they're recognized and automatically linked together, which is called a soft match because it's a matching that happens during the synchronization process. Or you can be very persistent and create a hard match where you will automatically or manually, sorry, calculate what they call the immutable ID. The immutable ID is a value that you give the on-premises account. You take that value, base64 encode it, and then stick it up the object in Office 365. And then once the synchronization engine runs, it says, well, I've got an object here with immutable ID X. And I now see an object in the cloud with immutable ID X. So they must belong together. I'll link them together. Whether the UPN matches or not does not even come into play at that point in time. There is some really good ways of doing that, and it's actually fairly easy, especially with the later changes they made into Office 365, sorry, into the Azure Active Directory synchronization engine. It becomes a breeze to do that. And to be honest, a few years ago, I would probably have done hard matching, because, you know, scripts to calculate values is very easy to create and then stamp them into Office 365. But I found that doing the matching based on user principal name works equally well, takes less time. There's good reporting on what it does and doesn't do. And if you know your way around Azure Active Directory Connect, then you can easily take that as feedback and use that to troubleshoot any issues that you come across. Are there third-party alternative solutions? Well, I've mentioned them earlier, so you can definitely take a look there. Yes?
I think there's one option that Warren should have mentioned, and that's the express migration option.
Yes. Yes. No. Ha, interesting. I do not have the express migration. So the express migration it's an interesting point. So what I suggest that we do with the express migration, let's hold on for that. Let's move that one to session two, which is back to back with this one, and continue diving into that because it kind of dives into hybrid migrations, simple MRS migrations, and doing stuff in that way. So yes, is really interesting as well. So that was the non-DirSync option. We've got the DirSync options. I'm going to speed up here a little bit because a lot of the things I'm going to talk about now are fairly the same. Obviously, cutover is one thing, staged exchange migration is the other thing. I'll ask the same question. Who has used staged exchange migration before? Wow, the same people. You're brave, brave souls. So the staged migration problem is, it's a problem in itself. The staged migration solution itself is not very flexible, nor is the cutover exchange migration. There's very limited use cases where you can use it. It doesn't work with newer exchange versions because of the conversion of a mailbox to a mail-enabled user and so forth and so on. Again, is it free? Yes. If you don't want to spend any money, go ahead and have your way, especially if you're on an older version of Exchange. It might actually solve some of your problems, and it works well. I mean, the migrations themselves, even though I don't believe that Microsoft has written the migration engines that fuel the cutover exchange migration or the staged exchange migration, they run fairly well, and you know that is not the problem. It's just, again, the end user experience around those types of migrations. Limitations exist, obviously. You have to have dir sync. It's not a hybrid solution. Just it's not Exchange hybrid. It is hybrid because you have on-premises and cloud components, but it's not Exchange hybrid because you're not invoking the hybrid configuration wizard. What it will do for you is convert the on-premises account to a mail-enabled user, and the mail-enabled user's address is pointing directly to Office 365, which means that you can move users while keeping other users on-premises and maintain mail routing and all that. There's no free busy, there's no additional items, and so forth and so on. Now, mentioning this, staged exchange migration limited to older versions of the Exchange. If you're on newer versions of Exchange, which you should be because all the other ones are out of support anyway, then you can do the staged, simple MRS. I keep calling it simple MRS, but it's the minimal hybrid configuration option. The minimal hybrid configuration option is basically hybrid without any of the additional hybrid features. It just allows you to move a mailbox, gives you the benefit that you don't have to resynchronize your Outlook clients, and it does give you mail flow coexistence without having to do anything additional, which seems like a really good option. Truth be told, since Microsoft has introduced the minimal hybrid configuration, if you're on 2010, 2013, 2016, you're not looking to build an Exchange hybrid with all the additional features, it is the best option ever invented in the solution. The reason why I think that Microsoft has created it is because a lot of people were doing minimal hybrid, but in an unsupported way, and now people can do it in a supported way, which is much better, of course, right? We're going to dive into how it works under the hood later, but basically there is no magic going on there. It's a mailbox move like any other migration solution. Anyway, skipping over some of the images here, what are the benefits of a staged migration, or what are some of the downsides is no one ever uses it. So I talked about 5 minutes for staged migrations. And why did I talk 5 minutes for something I would never recommend is because people, including myself, have used hybrid as a vehicle to migrate people and use it as the answer to all questions. Like, how should we move? Hybrid, it's the best option. And it is from an end user perspective, but it isn't always, right? Hybrid is just one way of solving a problem. There's nothing wrong with, you know, going down alternative paths. The only reason why you should go hybrid, and full hybrid that is if you need long-term coexistence. If you really want to maintain users on-premises and users in the cloud. If you have a long migration ahead where a lot of people on-premises or a lot of mailboxes on-premises need to be moved and you can't move them because they're geographically dispersed or it'll take you 6 months to move them and you need coexistence in the meantime, yes, hybrid is a great way. But anything less than that, you don't have to go through all the trouble of going through hybrid. Then doing the minimal hybrid is a better way because it allows you to move mailboxes pretty quickly. With the same reporting and all the capabilities, yes, you don't get free busy, although you could theoretically set up free busy really quickly, but that's a great way. But there are alternatives called third-party tools. And this is a shout out to a lot of these third-party tools because trying to do things yourself, that works great. And in very complex scenarios, sometimes you don't have another option than to build your own migration solution. The lots of scripts, I mean, you know, Janine is doing that right now, costing half of his life. No, just kidding. But there's a lot of time that goes into that. And sometimes you just need to do that if you have a very specific on-premises solution. But for, I'm going to say 85% of the use cases, there's a third-party tool. And the money you spend on a tool to do things for you is probably going to cost you less than trying to figure out things on your own, right? So I'm not advocating one or the other solution. You have to pick it yourself. But just know that I, personally, through experience, have become a really big fan of some of these solutions. Anyway, moving from cutover to staged to another Dersing solution is the hybrid exchange migration. Obviously, this is the best of everything. I don't know why I think that, but MRS move, moving a mailbox using the same principle as we've always done on premises, being able to move a mailbox from one end to the other end, maintain the OST file, which is a biggie, right? Because you don't have to reconfigure the Outlook profile, it does that for itself. Wrong. It does that for itself in about 80% of the cases. I've got a customer right now, 20% of mailboxes that are moved to the cloud for whatever reason, Outlook just says, I really don't feel like reconnecting to the cloud mailbox. And you know, if you follow the connections and everything goes well, AutoDiscover works and it gets pointed to the cloud and it's like, okay, so my AutoDiscover profile updated and it's now connecting to the cloud and it stops. Create a new profile in Outlook and it starts working. And yes, they're running click to run 2016 latest version or click to run 2013 latest version. It doesn't really matter. Now, this being said, I've had better successes where up to 95% was connected really, really well. But do not expect that every client will connect directly back to the mailbox in the cloud. I've had mixed results. So the reality is that you still will have end user interventions. You will still have to reconfigure Outlook profiles and you will still have to re-download some of the content. Now, Outlook isn't the most problematic piece to connect to Office 365. It's those bloody mobile devices. So if you have mobile devices using ActiveSync and no mobile device management solution, whether it be Good or Mobile Iron or anything else, there's AirWatch and so forth and so on, which can reconfigure profiles for you by the single click of a button, then you can hope that clients connecting using ActiveSync actually get redirected and then connect back to Office 365, which works really well on iPhone devices. I've had really good results there, but then there's that black behemoth called Android. And for some reason, I've got nothing against Android, but a lot of these devices just don't get the 302 redirect. I don't know why. I mean, two identical devices, one of which will reconnect and the other one won't. There is just no logic. Truth be told, I've never took the time to really troubleshoot that and figure out why one would and why one wouldn't, because it's just easier to tell them, well, here's the, you've done it before, set it up, just delete a profile, create a new one. Hey, life is happy, takes 2 minutes. And that is a very valid approach. Maybe someone else has had different experiences, and in that case, I'm more than happy to hear those. But that's just reality of doing migrations. Anyway, while we're at the topic of hybrids, and I do realize I have 1 minute left for about 23 slides. I said something about running over time. This is it. The hybrid, which version of hybrid do you use? Whatever is available. If you are on 2010, please stay there. It's very cozy. It gives you a warm feeling. 2010 has been around for a while. It's your best buddy and it'll do just fine. If you're in 2013, great. Life's fun. If you're in 2016, you're kind of living on the edge. Although, 2016 has become more mature. It lost some of the problems that it had in the early days. But truth is, the new hybrid configuration wizard, it's the same for all platforms and migrations work in exactly the same way. So if you're on 2010, stay there, migrate, then upgrade to 2016. Why? Upgrading on-premises from 2010 to 2016 requires you to do what they call a namespace switchover. The namespace switchover is what is the biggest impact to your clients on-premises, because you have to build up a new infrastructure for 2016, then change over these namespaces, and then have a coexistence between 2016 and 2010, and then hopefully nothing breaks in the process. Well, there's AutoDiscover caching, I heard. Anyone heard about the AutoDiscover caching things, problems? Yeah. So has anyone done a 2016 migration on premises? One, two, wow. Let the record show that only two people showed their hands of the entire room. Okay, so 2016, I believe later versions of 2013 as well have introduced caching of AutoDiscover. So previously, moving from 2007 to 2010, going way, way back, moved a mailbox to 2010, did AutoDiscover, discovered its new settings and instantly connected to the new mailbox in Exchange 2010 at that point in time. Take mailbox in 2010. move it to Exchange 2016. It might take up to an hour before it's smart enough to understand it has been moved to 2016. Because the auto discover results, if you've previously done auto discover through Exchange 2016, is being cached for an hour. After an hour, that cache is flushed and it'll rediscover its new settings. One of the reasons why that has been done is obviously to speed up the auto discover process so it doesn't need to go fetch or calculate the results for auto discover. So I can applaud the fact that they want to be very smart about doing that. The problem is, if you're caching all results and you're passing back old results to your Outlook client, well, that client cannot connect to its mailbox in a new location. It used to be worse because I believe, what was it, CU 2 or 3? When they first introduced the feature, it was 24 hours. Then I think in a subsequent update, it was 12 hours. Now it's up to 1 or 2 hours. Solution is very simple. There is an application pool called the Auto Discover application pool, reset. And then the cache is lost. Anyway, those are realistic problems that you face. This is also why you don't want to upgrade to 2016 on premises. There is no benefit of using 2016. Normally, this is when someone jumps and says, well, there is a benefit. Yes, there is one benefit that you get with 2013 or 2016. You can use OAuth. So if you want to do cross-premises e-discovery, you know, the favorite topic of Tony, then you need OAuth. Then you need to move to 2013 or 2016 prior to doing hybrid, especially if you're going to do that for the long term. So again, I'm coming back to what I said earlier. Long term, upgrade first, move then. Great. Migrating, just migrate and then upgrade. Why do you need to upgrade afterwards? Well, very simple. You've got that 2010 server. You're going to move to the cloud. You still need to keep that 2010 server for management purposes. Well, you want to make sure that it's up to par and uses the, you know, the web-based interfaces and all that. Then you upgrade that single server that remains to 2016. There's no impact, there's no users on premises. So you can just happily live ever after without having to think about migrating those user accounts because you've already moved the mailboxes to the cloud. Now, this being said, I had to stop 3 minutes ago, didn't I? You have no idea. Oh no, actually I've got 7 minutes left. Right, that's good. Anyway, so far for time management. Hybrid servers. Let me tell you one thing. Doesn't exist. Does not exist. Have I said that a hybrid server does not exist? Why not? It is just an Exchange server as any other Exchange server. It is an Exchange server that lives in your environment, is already there today. This is also one of the reasons why there is no sizing guide for Exchange Hybrid. There's no reason to size for hybrid. First of all, hybrid uses the same protocols that exist today. It will move mailboxes from your on-premises environment to Office 365. And if you are a good administrator, you should be moving mailboxes in your environment regularly as well. So the next question, quick show of hands, who is a good administrator and moves mailboxes in their on-premises environment from time to time from one database to the other one? Wow. Shame on you. Why not? Can anyone tell me why I think it's a good idea to move mailboxes? Yes?
Because if you move a mailbox, it gets repaired automatically.
There you go. There you go. So probably you've had migrations before where a mailbox is on a server and that mailbox contains data that has been there for a very, 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 very long time, has probably been migrated from 4.0 to 5 to whatever, 2000, 2003, 2007, 2010, it drags along 15 years of history in email, and then you move mailboxes, and every time you move that mailbox, there's like corruption here, corruption there, whatever there is, during the migration. Well, to keep the data, you know, kind of happily flowing, if you move mailboxes from time to time, then IMRS will actually cleanse mailbox contents, get rid of that corruption while they move from one end to the of the service of your on-premise service to the other one. That's also why mailboxes are moved from time to time in Office 365. Just, you know, I invite you, take a look at where your mailbox is located today and take another look in a few weeks' time. Chances are very, very large that that mailbox is now living in a different database. So there's good reasons why you should do that, especially if you're in a large environment with a lot of data or, you know, long history of data that is kept in mailboxes, it's always a good idea to do so. Anyway, provided that you regularly move mailboxes on premises, then you have already the excess capacity in your environment from a CPU perspective to handle mailbox moves, right? It's actually one of the items in the mailbox role requirements calculator. It asks you how many percentage of mailbox moves do you intend to do in the environment. I think the default is 5% or 3% or 5%. You can up that if you want to, you can lower it a little bit, but that is actually used to calculate a little bit of the CPU performance that is needed to run your on-premises environment. So if you've done your homework and if you've done your sizing right, you already have a performance from a CPU perspective. So do you need to add servers, hybrid servers, in order to get them to move to the cloud? No. Will you have more connections into your environment? Absolutely not. You'll have a few connections into your environment to move the mailbox and maybe a few cross-premises connections once the mailbox is moved. But once the mailbox is moved, the user connects to the cloud directly. Might do auto-discover on-premises, but then connects to the mailbox in Office 365. So as you are offboarding people, you actually need less performance, less servers. So you actually need to start removing servers instead of adding them, which all adds up to the idea there is no hybrid server. Obviously, if you're undersized on-premises, then yes, you might want to add an Exchange server. If you have multiple geographical locations, then yes, it might make sense to add additional services in those other geographical sites in order to have a direct connection for my mailbox migrations. But we can talk about that definitely later. I've already discussed the 2010-2016 coexistence. But just keep in mind that it's much easier to manage your hybrid coexistence when you're on 2010, but you don't need it. You don't want to do the migration, so migrate first, then upgrade to 2016 as soon as you can. That would absolutely be my my recommendation. I think Microsoft has understood that hybrid and migrating from hybrid to the cloud is probably one of the most popular ways of moving mailboxes. That is also why the portal, the tools, the tooling in general that Microsoft provides is very geared towards simple or minimal hybrid mailbox moves or showing the status for DirSync. The DirSync reports, by the way, in the portal, which are fairly new, are really good. Anyone uses Azure AD Connect here? Whom of you that uses Azure AD Connect also uses Azure AD Connect Health? Oh, come on, guys. The Azure AD Connect Health is a really great way to monitor your on-premises Azure AD Connect and ADFS environment if you have one. It's built in. I'm not going to say for free because you have to have the right licenses. But if you do have those licenses, it can show you really value of how Azure AD Connect is performing, how synchronization is doing, and it can go up to the level of password synchronization, object synchronization, and so forth and so on, using the built-in reportings that are available. Anyway, initiating a mailbox move is not from on-prem to the cloud. It's from the cloud to on-premises. So if you ever initiate a mailbox move using the tools, you log into the on-premises EAC. Then you go to the hybrid part, which actually logs you into the Office 365 EAC. Then you go to the migration tab and then migrate users. Or you just log in into the Office 365 portal, go to the same migration tab, and from the migration tab, you can actually migrate users to on-premises. Or you log into the portal, go to the users tab, not even in the EAC, and from there, you can even initiate a remote mailbox move. Or you can use PowerShell. PowerShell in Exchange Online, that is, because the connection is from the cloud into your environment, pulls the data into Office 365. There's many ways, very flexible. And of course, if you're doing, you know, your initial testing migration, use the GUI all you want. But if you've got multiple batches, multiple users, multiple thousand users that you want to move, then PowerShell is your friend. It's always been your friend. It's been our friend in Exchange since 2007, and it continues to be our best friend in doing anything else, migration-wise, management-wise, and so forth and so on. There's very little things that you cannot do in PowerShell, that you cannot do in a much more easy way in PowerShell than what you can do in the cloud. The exception being the new Azure AD commandlets. I absolutely hate them. I've had an interesting discussion earlier with Tony on that. As we are working on our new version of the Office 365 book, one of the efforts that we're going through is converting the MSOL commandlets to Azure AD commandlets. Oh boy, that's a real chore. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but truth be told, it's better to be aware that they are there, what they can do, and adopt them as quickly as you can, because you know eventually we'll move to these new commandlets, and whatever you used to be able to do using the old MSOL commandlets will not be possible anymore. But I think you're still safer the next few months, regardless. Good. So again, Exchange Hybrid is all about the experience and coexistence. You will keep the Exchange servers on premises. That was a lost point. So interestingly, this is actually an edit point I made on Yap's presentation. He sent the presentation, he said, public folders, dot, dot, dot. Has anyone heard anything about it? Well, up until a month ago, they're moving public folders, modern public folders, was not possible. Today, you can move modern public folders from your on-premises environment into Office 365. Has anyone attempted the process? Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I wholeheartedly agree. Has anyone migrated public folders, modern public folders on premises?
Yes.
I mean, from legacy to modern public folders, yes. It's pretty much the same process, kind of, looks like it, with scriptings and doing stuff all over the place. It's horrible. I just wish they could have invented something that says move public folder mailbox. That would have been so great. Yes. Unfortunately, that is not the case. So do understand that this is also one of the reasons why if you're on 2010 today, you are blessed, right? You don't want to move to 2013 to lock yourself into these modern public folders. You want to do 2010, move mailboxes, move public folders in a much easier way and then upgrade to 2013. Now, this being said, the process, I tried it the other day, it works. Once you go through the different steps and, you know, to the Microsoft's merit, the description or the steps that are outlined on TechNet, I was going to say, but it's Docs now these days or whatever it's called. They're pretty detailed. And if you follow them to the letter, you'll actually get where you need to be. Is it ideal? No, but it lifts a deployment blocker. I mean, I've known some customers that couldn't move to Office 365 because they couldn't move public folders. Well, that isn't entirely true. I think Binary Tree has a solution that moves public folders from on-premises to the cloud. So again, that is where the value of third-party tools can come in. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. Binary Tree, Priyasoft, Quadratech, all have solutions that can do additional things, even with a hybrid scenario that can solve problems that Microsoft doesn't solve or cannot solve or solves in a really, really bad way, right? Keeping public folders in sync. I know Binary Tree solution keeps them in sync on premises and in the cloud. So you can actually have some sort of coexistence, whereas Microsoft solutions is, well, either here or there. You can set up hybrid public folders, which means that users in the cloud are connecting to your on-premises public folders. Nightmare from a connectivity and Outlook perspective, really slow as hell. You don't want to go there. But these are, you know, potentially viable solutions if you assess them for what they're worth and what they can actually do. Now, this being said, I did run over time, so I'm going to wrap up here. If you have any questions, hold them to yourself. You can ask them in the next session. I'll give you 10 minutes to refresh a little bit, and we'll see each other in a few minutes.